So I welcome all of you for English medium Dhamma discussion. We were discussing various suttas from Attaka Vagga in Sutta Nipata, and we started Tuvataka Sutta. Again, this sutta is also based on a kind of a conversation between the prepared or created Buddha and the Buddha himself. So Buddha answers in a way more into practice oriented, and the verses are quite concise but contains a lot of deep meanings, we can say. And we already completed three or four verses. Actually, we have completed where Buddha answering how various kinds of conceptual proliferations generate, and he mentioned for that the sense of I, the I am, the sense I am is the root cause. And if one is capable of understanding that through wisdom, and then the internal craving can be abandoned, and such way one has to restrain oneself. Mulam papancha sankhaya manta asmiti sabbang uparundhi yakachi tanha jhattang tasang vinaya sada sato sikhe. Now this very verse is very, very interesting and very, very deep. And where Buddha highlights what is the root cause of different forms of conceptual proliferation. So that is asmi, the sense I am. And one has to recognize that, abandon that. And so that one can abandon even craving, which is the internal craving here highlighted. And in order to do that, so one has to be constantly diligent, mindful, and then restrain oneself. And then it's getting to another side, that is the mana, the conceit side. The other two verses are dealing with the conceit. Yankinchi dhammang abhinya ajjhattang athavapi bahidda natena manang kubbeta nahisa nibbuti satang butta. Then seyo na tena manyaya nicheyo athava api sarikho putto aneka rupehi natumanang vikappayan titthi. Now basically different forms of conceit is possible due to various causes, conditions, reasons, and in any of those causes one does not get into any kind of conceited state of mind. So different possibilities are there. Three main possibilities are explained in this last verse that we have discussed. So either the one can be considered oneself as superior to the others, and one can consider oneself as inferior to the others or equal to the others. So those are the three main forms of conceit, and that such conceit can happen due to various causes. And here one thing highlighted in the Sinhala translation, that is the one's caste. So if one is from higher caste, so he can consider the others are from lower caste. As a result of that, one can have a lot of conceit and one can look down the others. So that is highlighted in this particular kind of translation. But not only that, there are many, many other reasons that one can become conceited. So that is where we are, and we already discussed these four verses. And now we are getting to, according to Sinhala book, it is 924th verse. And maybe in English book, I don't know whether 19th verse. So let me recite the verse in Pali. Majhe yata samuddhasa umino jayati titho hoti. Evang titho anejasa ussadam bhikkhu na kareya kohinchi. Majhe yata samuddhasa umino jayati titho hoti. Evang titho anejasa ussadam bhikkhu na kareya kohinchi. So the Sinhala translation goes like this. Mahasagarayage madhya bhage yamse rala no hata ganid nischalava sitiye ved esein chinasro mahantema atalo dahamin nosale sitiye trushna rahita vanneya e mahana kisivek yudu utsada no karanneya. Now this is the Sinhala verse, the Sinhala translation. So the simile given is the great ocean. Sorry? Oh, I see. Oh, that didn't, we did that. 19th. So that is the, so I get the 20th, right? Okay, sorry. So ajjattame upasame na anyato bhikkhu santi meseya. Ajjattang upasantassa natti atta kuto niratta va. So that's the verse that we need to start with. Ajjattame upasame na anyato bhikkhu santi meseya. Ajjattang upasantassa natti atta kuto niratta. So the singular translation goes like this. Mahana adhyatmehi ragadhya sansindu vanneya. Satipatthanadhya hera. Anyavu ashuddhi margin chanti nosayanne. Adhyatmehi ragadhya sansindunu mahanahata atma drushti natha. Uccheda drushtiya ho koying veda. So if I translate as Sinhala translation, so it mentioned that internally one may subsides, one may abandon the lust, ajjatame upasame, and become tranquil. Na anyato bhikkhu santi meseya, and one may not search kind of a purification apart from the various different forms of mindfulness and such kind of Buddha mentioned methods are there. Other than that, one is not searching for any sort of wrong ways of purification. And then ajjattang upasantas, the one who has tranquilled internally, natti atta, there is no any kind of self view or any kind of wrong view. Kuto niratta, and there is no any kind of what you call uccheda ditti, what's that, annihilationism. So annihilation, we can say uccheda ditti. So there is no even that. So basically it talks about ditti, various different forms of wrong views, either eternalism or annihilationism. Yeah, annihilationism. So either one of these. So there is, those are the two extremes typically people can get into. And there is no such kind of wrong views to a person who is internally quenched, internally calmed. And so that's very much we can get from the Sinhala meaning. Maybe you can start with the English translation so that we can get a deeper meaning.
Yeah, the English translation is not as I'll read it out. It is internally that he should achieve peace. A bhikkhu should not seek peace through another. For one who is at peace with himself, there is nothing taken up, much less rejected.
Mm-hmm. Much less rejected.
Rejected, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you repeat that last statement?
For one who is at peace with himself, there is nothing taken up, much less rejected.
Much less rejected. So here it is going, ajjattang upasantassa natti atta kuto niratta.
So the other translation here is much less anything laid down.
Much less anything laid down.
Laid down.
Laid down.
Mm-hmm. For one who is at peace with himself, there is nothing taken up. How much less anything laid down?
Mm-hmm. What did you get from that, according to your understanding?
They're not reading the doctrine as much into it as your version in Sinhalese. Mm. So, I didn't read the Pali of it, so I don't know what the underlining meaning. It's much more poetic. It's much lighter, but it's more vague.
Yeah,
yours is more precise.
Yeah, India, actually the last two statements here, ajjattang upasanta, so that means internally if one is tranquil, happy, composed, and natti atta, and he doesn't have a feeling of atta, doesn't have a feeling of I am, or I, a self, and kuto niratta, and he doesn't have the opposite either, so I am not, or kind of annihilationism, where he completely sort of rejects himself or completely annihilate himself. So there is no, he is not getting to the any sort of extremes, either self or not self, both. So basically both, he doesn't have such kind of views.
Yeah, for one who is at peace with himself, there is nothing taken up, much less rejected.
Mm. So not absorbing, not rejecting.
Yeah.
It's that kind of a way we can say. Yeah. So anything we can, you like to add, Asma? You have anything coming from the commentaries?
So for internally achieving peace, that refers to defilements such as lust, etc. Not from another, not taking up, you know, practices of some other way. So that would be putting aside the four foundations of mindfulness, etc., to seek peace by some other method. Is internally that he should achieve peace, internally stilling lust, hatred, delusion, anger, all unwholesome volitional activities. Bhikkhu should not seek peace through another, any impure path, wrong practice, non-emancipating course, apart from the four establishments of mindfulness, and so on through the Noble Eightfold Path. For one who is at peace with himself, lust is allayed internally, extinguished, made to subside. There is nothing taken up, much less rejected. Taken up, there is no view of self for him. There is no more renewed existence with its wandering on in birth and death. So, that's all the comments.
So I think that actually we can connect this to what we call Silabbata Paramasa. So various different forms of rituals are there, various adherences are there. Thinking that by implementing that, by adhering to that, observing that, I can attain purification. Say in the, even now it may be available, like people are behaving like dogs, behaving like gods, ajavata, grovata. So likewise different forms of some austere practices are available, particularly in the Nigantas, say naked ascetics. So they are getting to some extreme different forms of austere practices and thinking that the purification is possible through that. And say sometimes people are bathing in the Ganges, different rivers, expecting the washing out of defilements, the internal, kamma, previous kamma. So such practices are there. And worshipping the god, whoever, whatever the god, and expecting he may purify myself. So likewise, different forms of beliefs are there that you can adhere to, and we can include everything. Actually, the one who is in the practice, he doesn't consider any of these would give any such kind of purification apart from the internal development of the faculties, internal development of for Satipatthana, say spiritual faculties, spiritual powers, seven enlightenment factors, Noble Eightfold Path. So it's very much like internalizing the whole thing, not expecting that someone else to come and purify me. Another observance may purify me. And there's an interesting point, actually. I can remember in one another sutta, where Buddha asked from Venerable Ananda, so what do you think, Ananda? This all forms of religious adherences, all forms of such observances are not necessary, or are they necessary? Are they useful or not useful? Are they leading to the purification or not leading to the purification? What do you think that Ananda would have mentioned, answered? So has he completely neglected, rejected everything? Or so he actually, Ananda, Venerable Ananda mentioned, I can't give a definite answer. Can't give a definite answer. It depends on whether such kind of an observance would cause to generate wholesomeness or wholesome states in your mind, or would it generate unwholesome states in your mind. So if the wholesome side is improving, increasing, and the unwholesome side is decreasing, then we can say, okay, that is something good. We can continue that adherence, that whatever the ritual. But on the other hand, if a particular ritual is causing kind of agitation or any sort of unwholesome states to develop in one's mind, then that is not a suitable form of adherence. So therefore, the determining factor has to be whether internally one may get the wholesome side developed unwholesome side sort of decrease, that is the criteria that we have to use in order to determine whether a form of ritual is good or bad. So that is mentioned, I can't remember the exact name, recently we have used that in Singhala discourse. So that is very interesting highlighted, and then Buddha praised Venerable Ananda. He's quite an intelligent monk, and he properly understood the situation. It is not that we have to completely abandon everything. Rather, if some sort of ritual is useful for one's internal development of the wholesome side, yes, then you can practice that. If not, not necessary. So that is the kind of criteria. So anyone else like to contribute?
So maybe I'll just go give a read through it again. It is internally that he should achieve peace. A bhikkhu should not seek peace through another. So again, when I read this, I hear the first Dhammapada verse almost, that we be a lighthouse unto ourselves. And then also that, again, most of the religions, they put an emphasis on some god or some organization or some other place where you achieve peace. But here in Buddhism, the Buddha points back to that the problem and the solution is found within this fathom-long body. So it's very important to know where the problem is and where the solution can be found. Because if we see the problem as external to ourselves, then we're looking in the wrong place. And then if we see that the solution is external to ourselves, we're also looking in the wrong place. And so I would say most people are looking in the wrong place for both the problem and the solution. Whereas here it cuts right down to the core of where the problem and the solution can be found. And I also find it very empowering that the Buddha gives the agency to the bhikkhu themselves. So he's not putting himself forward as the great liberator or anything like that. The power and the agency is with the bhikkhu himself to internally find his own problem and solution. Yeah. So for one who is at peace within himself, there is nothing taking up, much less rejected. So again, continuing that theme, that for one who is at peace within himself. So again, people talk about that there's a lack of peace in the world, but the only world that matters is the world within oneself. And it's about not taking up, trying to take up the peace from the external world or trying to take up the conflict from the external world. Nor is it also about rejection. So here again, we're in the middle way. It's about not taking up and not rejecting at the same time. So it's a very dynamic teaching that he's talking about. It's not an extreme, that you don't find Buddhism in the extreme. It's not right wing or left wing. It's in the middle way. So it's not taking up and it's not rejecting. So again, referring back to your comment with Ananda, it's indeterminate whether we should reject or take up the rituals of other organizations or other groups or different things. If it's guiding one towards peace within oneself, then it may have some merit. So it's a very short verse, but very cryptic and very deep. So I can understand why in the Sinhalese they read in more of a doctrinated grounding into the ideology, you know, saying, well, it's referring to these teachings and that. But in essence, it's much more simple and much more primitive, meaning he's talking about something really fundamental, like which is where the problem is and where the solutions are to be found. And like if you're sitting alone in a forest, like as a forest monk, then it's very empowering to know that you have the full set to tackle the problem with you, that the problem is within yourself and the solution is within yourself, that you can be at, that you strive to make peace with yourself, that you try to get this dynamic going between not taking up and not rejecting, and as Venerable Chandaratana mentioned, it all the from this proliferates all these different views. So we have the extremes of craving, taking up, and we have the extremes of this nihilism, rejection, or annihilationism, complete rejection. So we can see the range of views that immediately flow out from, you know, we can have this belief that there is one God, and that I'm the little piece missing from the one God, and I need to reunify with the one God, or something like that. All these other views, this is the right view that he's presenting right here, and all these other views are wrong views. So sometimes the simplicity, the genius of what he's talking about here, is only its simple beauty is only to be seen clearly when you start to look at the horror show of where people get all of this wrong, and they're in this thicket of views, they're taking up all of these weird practices, rejecting this and that, you know, it gets really thorny and thick and very, you know, not going anywhere. It's you're bogged down. And whereas this is just really beautiful and simple, it is internally that he should achieve the peace. A bhikkhu does not seek peace through another. For one who is at peace within himself, there is nothing taken up, much less rejected. So the beauty and the simplicity of what the Buddha is talking about here, I mean, like I said, you have to just look around and you see the horror show of everything else. How all these other religious views get it wrong, or how these political views get it wrong, because they're looking in the wrong place. They're blaming the world for their problems. You know, you're the cause of my suffering. And they're taking up things, or they're rejecting things. Whereas Buddhism is this very dynamic, very live practice of patiently watching one's own mind, cultivating peace, and also being very skillful in what you take up and very skillful in what you reject. It requires an intelligence and an internal watching all the time, that you know what you're taking up and you know what you're rejecting, and is it bringing you to peace or not? And that's can be a very personal, very very private kind of an understanding. So, you know, we're not out burning down the enemies as a result, because we understand that it's within. And that's to know where the battleground is incredibly important. Because people are constantly being misdirected by the defilements, by their own confusion, by views, by all of these other things. So again, we need to look at this verse in that light, that the Buddha has intensely clarified and made it extremely clear, very simple. And that is its beauty for me anyway, when I read this.
Yeah, thank you. So actually, I thought of adding what Buddharakta highlighted. So when you are talking about different views, so directly, actually in Kacchanagotta Sutta, if you can remember, one monk come and ask what is the correct view. So there Buddha highlights what's the typically how mind behaves. So there Buddha mentioned not only that either craving and then we are getting attracted to that and then rejecting, but other than that, there are kind of a dualistic thinking in our mind. So there Buddha mentioned dvayanisito koyan kacchana loko yebhiye atitan cheva natitancha. So it's the form of thinking, our pattern of thinking is mostly dualistic. So we consider things as they are it is, and there it is not. So is or is not. So we constantly jumping from the negativity or the positivity. So that is the typical habituated way of thinking, how we are thinking. So there Buddha mentioned so dualistic thinking is leading us to a form of kind of confusion, and get into anger and get into all different forms of arguments. And as he mentioned, So Buddha's teaching, therefore, hasn't taken to those extremes either. So he is coming up with a different approach, where when there is ignorance, then the possibility of doing various kind of formations, and then he's explaining about the condition that is a dependent arising, the Patisamuppada. So his view in that sense is based on Patisamuppada, and leaving aside the both extremes, taking something to be real or existing, really available, or completely annihilating and thinking it is not available, it is completely illusion, something like that. So when we have ignorance, yes, then we consider things are available, or we get into think that I am available, so there is a person available. If there is no ignorance, then we can't have such kind of ignorant personality view or something like that. So in that, that is being highlighted in the what you call in this Kacchanagotta Sutta. So other than taking only the mere extremes as craving and then rejecting, taking those two are the main extremes. So here we can get into another level where we have a kind of dualistic way of thinking. So those are leading to wrong views, considering that things are existing or not existing. Things are black or things are bad. White. Things are bad or these are good. So always thinking in that form. Yeah. Anything you add?
Okasimante, but I think Buddha, they are really simplifies the process because the way that I understood that Buddha wants us to take away all other practices and stick to Satipatthana.
Mm-hmm. So Satipatthana actually highlighted in the Sinhala and the, maybe in the commentary. When we are including Satipatthana, we can include all the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas. So Satipatthana, then 5-4 faculties, 4 strivings, and all these things can be included. So typically, that is how we are abbreviating the whole thing, referring Satipatthana. Yeah. So in other way, we can when we are talking about the Noble Eightfold Path, so it includes Sila, Samadhi, Panya. So that is the kind of the complete solution in a way. So it is Samadhi Panya, the morality side, then the Samadhi, the necessary amount of clarity or the concentration, collectedness of the mind, and then we are getting to the what we call the Panya, the wisdom side. Yeah.
But if I, am I correct if I put it in this way, like now there are lots of things that are going on, so here what Buddha expects us to do is to take all these things away and keep it away, and stick to the process of Satipatthana, mm-hmm, as a practice, the mode of practice.
Yeah.
So then that will be the only thing that will be focusing. Is it correct?
Yeah, actually when one is developing Satipatthana, one will automatically develop to the other levels. You are being carried away to the other levels of development. Say when you are developing Satipatthana, say you get into the development of 7 enlightenment factors. And then you are developing the understanding of what is, say, kind of a wisdom. The ignorance will be abandoned and you are getting the wisdom. So like mentioned in the Anapanasati Sutta, so where Buddha mentioned by developing Anapanasati as a one method, one technique, you can achieve all forms of Satipatthana. Kayanupassana, Vedanupassana, Chittanupassana, Dhammanupassana. So all forms of Satipatthana can be developed. So when one is developing all four types of Satipatthana, then automatically you may develop 7 enlightenment factors, 7 bojjhangas. And when you develop 7 bojjhangas, it leads to develop vijja vimutti. The vijja is the understanding, vimutti is the liberation. So they are going hand in hand. So likewise, it's a kind of a connected path. You can't take in isolation, okay, we are developing only the Satipatthana part. But when you are developing mindfulness, automatically the other necessary qualities start supporting you and you need them. So as you are continuing, they start supporting and you feel, okay, I have some amount of concentration, I have some amount of effort. Yes, I have faith on the Dhamma and the teaching, the practice. Okay, now I have wisdom. So likewise, all the other faculties come into the picture and it's get connected like. So, and again, that's why, I mean, in the certain suttas, like Mahachattalisika Sutta, so Buddha mentioned what is the right view, right samadhi, Samma Samadhi. So in there he defined Samma Samadhi as the proper alignment of all 7 other path factors. So you can't take in one form. So you can't take in isolation. So all the other seven path factors has to be full equilibrium. Then you are telling, okay, you are in the correct samadhi, in the right samadhi. So likewise, so everything is well connected and supporting each other. So in a way, it's beautiful. I mean, you may start from somewhere you are. See, it's maybe left, right, rising and falling. That's a very easy or so the kind of the very basic kind of practice. But slowly as you are continuing, all the necessary components will getting adding up, supporting each other, and you are getting to a very beautiful mental equilibrium, equipoise, we can say. Anything?
Avasarai Swaminasa. Yeah. Thank you, Mahasangha, for all the comments so far. And so actually, I know of a monk. His name is Bhante Chandana. And recently, he actually gave a talk on his YouTube channel about rituals. He had a talk on there. And I think more or less what he was saying is that the rituals being performed are only as good as the people doing them. So I think more or less, you know, it's like you see with other religions, you know, they have rituals like, you know, maybe they'll pray to a god or they'll, I don't know, give offerings to a statue or something like that. Or, you know, I think in the Buddhist time, people were dancing around fires too and stuff like that. So, you know, these things, you know, they don't, it's important to recognize that they don't purify you internally. So, if you're like, you know, a vegetarian, for example, and, you know, you're like going around, maybe you're sticking to that dietary practice, you know, but if you're kind of like going around and like trying to make everyone see the error in eating meat, I think there's a sutta where the Buddha is talking about raw stench, where he's like saying something like, you know, this is the raw stench, not eating meat. I can't remember exactly what sutta that's raw stench. I can't exactly, but I think he was like trying to say that like eating meat doesn't necessarily make you a bad person. I think that was the message.
Yeah. On the other hand, actually, when Devadatta asked for that as a kind of a vow for every monk to follow, so Buddha say, if you like, you can continue. If you don't need, you don't need to. I mean, it is not a must.
Yeah, yeah. So like clinging to things like that per se, like, you know, like, oh, you know, this is my dietary practice. I am not going to eat meat. But, you know, if you're still like going around and like you feel like a need to like make other people who, I guess, eat meat, you know, or, you know, you feel a need to make other people see how eating meat is, you know, inherently wrong and they're like a bad person. So that, like, I feel falls more or less, I guess that's related to what we're saying with, I guess, rituals. You know, so the things like, you know, the rituals like praying to gods and, you know, dancing around fires and, you know, other sorts of things like that, you know, it doesn't purify you internally. And the thing about the Buddhist teachings is that they have to be experienced directly by the individual. So it's a spiritual path where you, the individual, actually have to put in the work, you know. Like, yes, the Buddha can teach, you know, we have the suttas, we have the Vinaya, we have the teachings, but only the individual can actually practice and do the practice themselves and experience the teachings for themselves. So it's a religion or is a spiritual path, you know, that more or less you could say differs from maybe all other spiritual paths in the world, in the sense that you, the individual, have to put in the effort and you have to do the work and you have to do the practice. It's not like you can just, you know, have like an easy solution out, you know, and, you know, so yeah, that's my comment.
Yeah. So it is very beautifully highlighted in the Dhammapada. Tummehi kichang atappang akkhataro tathagata. Patipanna pamukkhanti jahaino mara bandana. So you yourself have to practice. Buddhas are merely the path showers, so the ones, the guidance. And patipanna pamukkhanti, and the one who is practicing will be liberated, jhayanti mara bandhun, mara bandhana. So the one who is practicing diligently, they are able to escape from the bondage of the mara. In point blank, Buddha has mentioned.
Yeah, you know, again, different from other religions and spirit, the Buddha's teachings are different from other religions and spiritual paths, where, you know, like in the case of, you know, like, I guess, you know, in the case of Protestant Christianity, because I think, you know, to my knowledge, essentially what they believe is like, you know, your faith alone will save you. Your faith in, you know, this God will save you. Your faith in the religion will save you. But, you know, it's the Buddha's teachings are a spiritual path where you, the individual, actually have to practice yourself. You have to change your own ways, your own habits, your own ways of thinking. And you can't depend on an external source. Like, you can't just pray to a God and, you know, the whole... everything is better. You know, you have to actually make the effort yourself, and you have to take personal, individual responsibility for your actions and for your life. So, thank you.
Yeah. So actually, unfortunately, even in Sri Lanka, how many people are asking from things from Buddha? You can see, I mean, with time, things have changed, and something came from Hinduism, and they are going to various gods. Even the temples have the different ritualistic practices like this god, that god, and etc. And now people are offering various things to Buddha and asking, okay, please give me this, please give me that. So you have lost the ground in that sense. So as you can see, so the suttas very, very directly highlights that you have to strive, you have to practice, you have to put forth effort, then only you can experience something. So therefore, it's quite unfortunate that somehow we have deviated from the original teachings of the Buddha. We have get on to a kind of a path where we are pleading and asking something, praying and all these things. But Buddha himself have rejected that. If the wishes and pleading and all these things are possible, then everybody will have everything, because they are asking and they are giving. Then why not are we asking the everything?
Sarai Swaminasa. Some people, you know, they may put more of, even Buddhists, you know, they may put more of an emphasis on like merit making. For example, just, you know, giving offerings and stuff, maybe doing pujas, like, you know, chanting and stuff like that. But, you know, while that is beautiful, that is, you know, good to like support the Sangha, and, you know, that helps the Sangha to survive. But, you know, people, you know, also, you know, they need to understand that, you know, that alone is not going to save you from suffering. You still have to. You still have to practice the Buddhist teachings, and you have to experience the teachings for yourself. You know, just making merit, again, it's a very beautiful, wonderful thing. It does help the Sangha survive, and absolutely it's essential for the survival of the Sangha. But, you know, that's not where it stops. The dana is, it doesn't stop at the dana. You have to, you know, then, you know, you have to cultivate sila, you have to practice meditation, and you have to actually experience the teachings. And, you know, that's the only way that you're going to be liberated from suffering.
Correct.
So, yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a great topic. I just wanted to make a small bit offering about what we're just speaking of is, when I, some teachers in Zen, you know, this just popped into my mind was they would, when we would have a retreat, they would say, see how your mind is and your how your mind goes when you go back to your dwelling and you're by yourself. And I think, you know, if we think about that, how we tend to, our defilements come up when we're alone and when we're... they also come up when we're around people, but just seeing how the mind goes, and we can see how our mind becomes greedy or is seeking sensual desire or becoming angry. You know, like when I get back to my dwelling, I may be thinking, oh, that guy, you know, he
suppressed my view.
Suppressed my view.
Idea.
He was not...
coordinating with me
was not kind, he was not kind to me. I'm mad at him, you know, just seeing how when we're kind of how our mind goes. So it just this has to do with this verse, which is, you know, for one who is at peace with himself, there is nothing taken up, much less rejected. So, you know, I think we tend to not so much reject, but we sort of push away.
And again, not taking it personally in that sense, right? I mean, natthi atta kuto niratta. We can connect to even that. Now, say when someone tells something, when someone criticizes you, immediately how we take it is that I am here, you are there, you are accusing me, I mean, you are blaming me. So I am immediately taking a person here. So now here Buddha mentioned, ajjattam upasantasya natthi atta kuto niratta. So there we can take it like, so when someone can abuse me, so if I am internally completely satisfied, completely calm, there is no self-view, then I don't need to worry about that. I mean, it's just sound. Oh, we can take it. Then that way, okay, that may be my karma, last karma. So it has now being spended. So if I am not taking it personally, and again, I am not attributing that also as a person, then I am at peace. So that is what actually Buddha highlighted. Even if you can remember that when monks were going in Pindapatha, arms round, that as a kind of a persuasion of Magandhya, so the one queen Magandhi, that people start abusing the Sangha, and then they come and complain the Buddha, let's leave this place, and while Buddha was in Kosambi. So then monks were asking, okay, let's leave this place, we can't stay. I mean, they are abusing us, they are using the harsh words while we are going on Pindapatha. And then what Buddha mentioned is, so don't take it personally. I mean, don't think that they are a person and you are a person. So if you are looking in that, then you are in trouble. So so it's a very beautiful verse, can't remember. I'll recall that while you are talking, yeah. Yeah, very interesting. I mean, so we can come to that point. So not taking things personally is another way that we can add to this word, I mean, to this verse. Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to also address this point earlier because we're flowing away from what he's talking about here to some degree from my perspective. Like when we talk about the Satipatthana and these technicalities, what the Buddha is talking here is how do you know even your Satipatthana practice is going okay or not? So he's emphasizing here the characteristic, the quality that you need in your practice. Like when I'm hearing this, I'm like rubbing my fingers because it's about this path of refinement and purification. So he's telling you, like, as you practice your Satipatthana or whatever you're doing, that it's a path of refinement. So you end up not moving out to this extreme of taking up and the other extreme of rejecting. And as you stay with the breath, it becomes more and more and more refined. So, I've just come back from teaching overseas. The problem I have to teach a lot of the, you know, novice meditators is, you know, they sit down, the first meditation is going smoothly for them because the breath is coarse. And then as they sit longer, the breath becomes more and more refined. They become, you know, more tranquil, more quiet, more calm down, more peaceful. But then they start to lose the breath and then it becomes boring. So they're moving in and out of this ability to stay with the breath, we'll say, or stay with their walking practice, or to stay with solitude. So they want calm, but they don't know how to develop and cultivate calm and peace and quiet and tranquility. They want to be with their breath, but they're not able to stay with the breath as it gets more and more refined. So I have to kind of reset their expectations and tell them that it is getting more and more refined and this is good. It's not that you lost attention. It's just the challenge has got more difficult as such. And the distractions, it's not necessarily that they're getting worse. It's just that your faculties are getting more refined. And so here, again, if I take this verse in a different way, I see it as a very clear description of the qualities and characteristics of good practice itself. So, you know, all of this other theoretical stuff about is this satipatthana? Is this dependent origination? You know, all of this is just proliferation out. Again, you have to come back to how are those fact? How are those theories, we'll say satipatthana and dependent origination, how are they actually operative in your momentary practice? And here, again, he's telling you this is the characteristic. This is the experience. This is, he's talking about it from the deep practitioner's perspective. And like you're having that sensitivity in your fingers. You know it's getting more and more refined. And you have that feeling. So you're going from the rough hemp down to the silk. And it's becoming more and more silky smooth. So you're not taking up and you're not rejecting. You're not taking up, you're not rejecting. It's very subtle. It's a subtle and more subtle experience. And that's you need to know what you're looking for. You need to know what good practice is. And this is good practice that he's talking about here. You know, this is the experience of good practice. So if you're in that space and then you start to look at the world in the opposite way, oh, I know that's rougher. Oh, I know that's a little bit more coarse in my life. I know that that's a little bit more proliferation. I know that's a little bit more doubtful. So, you know, when people start tearing apart, is this practice of meditation satipatthana or not? This is very destructive. That's a kind of a boredom or a kind of a doubt or a cognitive mind. Again, it's getting into this kind of primitive. What I'm using the word primitive, and it has this wrong meaning in English. It means, like, primitive means stupid. But I mean primitive meaning profound, fundamental. Yeah, like not complicated, like a kind of an ultimate characteristic or truth. This is an extremely fundamental thing that he's talking about here, that you need to know what to look for in your practice, and you need to know where the North Star is, and this is the North Star, and he's going to emphasize this in the next verse of a metaphor, a beautiful metaphor. I know you were looking for metaphors, but the next one is a killer metaphor. This is an extraordinary metaphor, the next one, and that's what we need to know in our practice, have that feel between your fingers of what good practice is. And just read this verse and try to put yourself in the Buddha's shoes. Like he's really showing you what it is to be a Buddha and how a Buddha is looking at the world and thinking about the world. So when you're in that place of not confusion, you start to see all the other stuff is complete rubbish. And you're rejecting, oh, that's false, that's false, that's false, that's false, that's false. And, you know, you can get very rejective in your mind. And it's sort of like you have to learn how to just drop it, drop that stuff. Like, I mean, sometimes myself and Dhammajiva are arguing about, like, what I call angertainment. You know, the new, you know, he's telling me about something on the news and I'm going, that's just bloody angertainment. Will you forget about it? You know what I mean? Like, you know, we have these sort of, like, he'll tell me about something about people taking drugs in LA. I don't care. It's nothing to do with me, you know. It's angertainment. Like the media, the news will try to pull out these. It's not news. It's a special kind of information that annoys the mind, and it's pulling you out. It's you're taking it up and you're rejecting it. It's like angertainment. Whereas this in this verse, the Buddha is pointing to a completely different mind state of where you're making peace, you're making peace, you're unhooking yourself from these ideas, especially ideas, thoughts, feelings, emotions. Like it was very interesting. Yesterday was my brother's birthday, and he died a long time ago. So I was reflecting on his life, and it was very interesting to not get hooked into the sadness and at the same time celebrate his life and try to remember him as he was and understand my own thinking about him now and so forth. Just, you know, getting to a peace, getting to a refinement about it where I'm having a kind of very simple experience of that person. And there is no that person anymore. There's just a kind of a thought within my own mind about that person. And it's how to bring oneself to peace. So this verse is not trivial. This is an extraordinary verse, but try to put yourself into that shoes. Try to put yourself into that shoes. And then look at these questions like Satipatthana and, you know, dependent origination. Like, just see them as like, I don't know how the Buddha thought of these other things. They're just extraordinary. Because when you're in this very simple mind state, it's very difficult to see these complicated ideas of Satipatthana and dependent origination. The Buddha was so genius at explaining these fundamentals. You know, he's like an Einstein or a Newton or something like that. Like, it boils down to something so simple, and once you see it, then suddenly you understand the way the planets are moving around the sun. And it's no longer the Earth is the center and the sun is moving around, and you get into all this crazy, crazy stuff, this Ptolemaic idea or something like that. I'm just saying, suddenly you can fly. Suddenly you can put up satellites. Suddenly you can do all kinds of stuff that was impossible before because you had the wrong idea.
Exactly. That's the one. So actually that verse actually that I forgot. Yes, remembered that in the Kosambiya, what Buddha mentioned to the Sangha is that Game Aranya Sukadukka Putto Neva Attano No Parato Dahiya. So Neva Attano No Parato. So you are not considering you as a person, and you don't consider that the others as a completely isolated separate group of persons. So if you take Neva Attano No Parato Dahiya. Pusanti pasta upading paticha nirupading kena puseyum pasa. So all these different contacts are contacting you, touching you based on your adherences, your upadis, nirupading kena puseyum pasa. If you don't have such acquisitions, if you are not identifying yourself with any of those things, then they can't touch you. They can't push your buttons, on the other terms. Yeah. So likewise, natthi atta kuto, now, as he mentioned, now he taken a very good practice example. Say when you are going towards, say, anapanasati or whatever other practice, so you may start with some gross objects, and it keep refining, become subtler and subtler. And when the object becomes subtler, your attention becomes subtler, and you can't establish yourself firmly. So as a result of that, so mind starts drifting. Either it can jump to the past, it can jump to the future, it can jump to this, that. So your mind again get little restless. But if you are capable of maintaining that refined equilibrium, so that is where, okay, ajjattang upasantas. So you are internally quenched, internally you are very calm, and your internal calmness is more and more refined. Suppose you are oscillating between very, very high amplitude. Assume that at the beginning you are oscillating in a very, very long amplitude. But as a result of the object becoming refined and refined, so this oscillation becomes less and less, and ultimately you are coming to the very much like the baseline. So you are now fairly homed, you are completely calmed down, you are came to the stillness in a way. So if you are able to maintain that state without any kind of agitation, not going to the any of the ups and downs, then you are at the very, very calmness. Actually, as he mentioned, the next verse is highlighting that. how you are at peace. You are in a very, very beautiful equipoise. Very interesting. I mean, how Buddha has put everything together and explaining in different ways, actually. Now we all can, I mean, explain this verse in many different ways. We can look into that verse in many different ways. All we can say, yes, something is true. And how it is moving forward, helping us to understand, okay, now it was pulsating, it was oscillating, but later slowly, it has come to the complete equilibrium. Now we are in the proper balance. Yeah.
Sarai Swami Naza.
Yeah.
Thank you for the comments. And I just also wanted to add that, with the reduction of when somebody reduces the conceit of I am, I guess one might assume that they're just less affected by everything in the world, like not even, you know, if someone else criticizes, not just, you know, if someone else criticizes them, they'll likely be less affected by that. But one might assume that they would also feel less of a need to criticize others, you know, be so critical about others. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I guess one might assume that they would even feel less of a need to be so critical towards others or critical of things in the world. And you know, again, I think they would be at peace with themselves. So mm-hmm. So
actually, here we can add another point where one can become kind of indifferent. So he is not sensitive to anything and is completely in kind of an indifference. So that is not actually we are highlighting here. So one can completely ignore others and he can mind his own business and not caring of anything else. So that is kind of an ignorant form of indifference. But here you have some kind of a understanding. Through understanding you accept, you are getting to a more deeper kind of an equilibrium. It does not mean that you are completely passive. So if it is necessary, you can help, you can be compassionate to another person, you can interact with another person, you can act properly depending on the situation. It is not that you become a completely passive form of indifference, but you are quite active, you are fully aware, but at the same time, internally there is no agitation. Internally you are at complete peace.
Yeah, sure.
I would actually say it's the opposite entirely to what you're saying. You know, the more at peace you become with yourself, the more aware you are of the disturbances in others. And you're not indifferent to others and how they're thinking and feeling. You're actually more sensitive to how they are. And I mean, I'll come back to some examples. They've done a lot of brain scanning on monks who, like to say, these Tibetan monks in particular, who do these particular practices. You know, they've done their 10,000, 20,000, 100,000 hours of compassion meditation. So they put them in a brain scanner, they show them somebody being injured or, you know, something that sort of evokes a sense of suffering. And they have a stronger response than an average person. So they experience it, they feel it more sensitive. So if somebody, if a door is crushing somebody's hand, you know, like somebody closes a car door on their hand, they can see the neurology of the meditator, all the lights in their brain, the neurons are firing about pain in their hand. So they experience the pain of the
person.
Yeah. More empathetic. You can put yourself completely in the feet or shoes of the other person. You feel it as if somebody slammed the door on your own hand. Mm. So you become highly sensitized to the experiences or the thoughts, the feelings of other people. It's just that you can process them and you're not reacting to them. You're responding to them. You're experiencing them. So I personally find that I'm not tuned out. I'm not numb. I experience music. Like again, there was a beautiful example where the Gandhabas come and play music for the Buddha. And the Buddha says at the end of the concert, he said, "You played well."
Panchasika to the Panchasika, yes.
It sounds very simple. You played well. Now, the Gandhabas must be the greatest musicians ever. Like, I'm sorry, the Beatles would not be close to the Gandhabas. And that kind of music would be extremely sophisticated and, you know, just exquisite. And
couldn't record it, by the way.
Huh?
Couldn't record it by that time.
No, but I had a friend. I know somebody who. Okay, they said that they could that they had heard the Devas playing music. And they said after that they could never listen to any other music. They said it was just so exquisite that you know. And the same with this kind of perfume or the food or this. There are things you cannot even imagine how exquisite. And after that, like, you can understand why the Devas would stand aside from the humans because they smelled. You were talking about stench earlier on. You stench. We stench to the Devas. We are bad. And, like, you have to appreciate how how refined actually a meditator can be, how refined their mind is. And it's not that they're rejecting these things, they're processing it. And it's yata bhuta dasana, so it is, so it is. And that the only the ultimate peace that we're trying to achieve here can only be achieved through wisdom. Again, it isn't that we become connoisseurs. These days there's such a thing about everybody's a connoisseur. You know, they know how to make the perfect coffee and the perfect tea and the perfect everything. And if you have it all right, this is going to be great. You know, like the Gandabas, they can do a great concert, but they're not bringing you to an ultimate peace. They're just bringing you to that momentary peace of a beautiful concert. And then after the concert, it's all over. It's done. You're back to reality again. And that's the temporary peace of, you know, a good concert, the hedonic pleasure. It's good, but it's not permanently good. Whereas wisdom is achieving a root cause peace. And once you experience that, then like, okay, the door slams in your hand, or you experience it as a meditator, you see somebody else suffering, but you're not pulled in, as he says here, you're not taken up and you're not rejecting that suffering. That's the difference. It's very alive.
No. It's all right.
This is a dialogue.
Yeah. It's a call and response. Correct. So that's why, both sides are now available. You become more sensitive. You are quite aware of even a slightest kind of a suffering another person is going through. You are more empathetic. At the same time, you have your absorbers or kind of shock absorbers. You can retain yourself. You are not emotionally moved. You are not getting to arguments. You are not going to attack, but you are not disturbed. You are fully aware. You are really sensitive. At the same time, you are in a kind of a cushion. In a kind of a shock absorber kind of a situation, you can absorb it. You're not reacting, so you are again calmed out. So very beautiful balance. I mean, very mature kind of balance. Yes, yeah. The next verse, deep, like you are at the deep ocean. You are extremely deep, but no waves. So, I mean, very very beautifully that Buddha highlights the state of the mind, that how it is being supported by a deep wisdom. At the same time, you are being very sensitive, and very, very beautiful. Anyway, time has passed. Okay, then we can wind up. We have discussed a very beautiful discussion we went through. And anyway, we completed just one verse. I mean, we don't need to rush in a way, because it's worth putting more our own so different views here, so that we can highlight some beauties that what Buddha wants to highlight, and then we can learn a lot. So I think therefore the direction we are moving is something good. So then we'll wind up the session, and maybe you can share the merits.
Okay, this is an experiment for all the people who are used to this super ritual, sharing the merits formulaically, dancing around their fire, dancing around the microphone. This is a different way, and you can test it against this verse we have today as your standard.
Exactly.
Does this bring you to calm and peace or not?
So you are going to do that, the English one, right? Not the traditional one.
So again, a lot of the people here listening in this room are traditional monks. You have to understand that what you're saying is gobbledygook and ritual to a lot of people outside of your bubble. I'm sorry to have to break news to you that people in the rest of the planet do not know what you're talking about when you chant in Pali. And it sounds very familiar to Sinhalese people who don't know what you're talking about either. So I teach a sharing of the merit where people actually know what they're talking about in English, plain and simple. And it's an experience, and you can compare it to this verse today. So I'd like you to feel we've gathered together, we've put the time and effort into gathering together, and what we've done is wholesome and meritorious. And I feel like it's like a dana, like you were putting the rice into the monk's bowl, and you have something meritorious to offer them. And you feel good about your dana, you feel good about the merit you've been doing. And just as you have the opportunity to offer this to the monks, you also share this merit with all other beings. So you can imagine all recipient beings, just as I remember my brother, and that he's partaking in this merit too. And I feel good about that. Not only am I generating merit for myself and for others, but I can share it with my ancestors, with my loved ones, those near and far away, and with all recipient beings. So the devas and all these other beings. So I just share that merit with all of them. Sadhu, 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 sadhu. So if you anybody else wants to do the verses, that's fine by me.
It's fine. I think all could understand. So then we'll wind up the session here.